Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook and at highlandradio.com.
This is the second hour of the 9 till noon show on a Thursday morning here in Highland Radio. It's Donal Kavanagh standing in for Greg. He and the team are travelling back today from Brussels after what was a very successful show, I think, from the European Parliament building yesterday. Congratulations to Greg and the team. Caroline did all the producing and Kevin did some of the engineering on the side and getting everything together from a social media point of view as well, and Donna Marie of course held the fort together back here. Great teamwork and a great show as a result. Greg back, as we say, tomorrow morning with the Friday panel and the entertainment slot and all the usual Friday goodies that we look forward to on the 9 till noon show. If you want to get in touch, it's 086 60 25,000 for your texts or WhatsApp messages. You can call us 074 91 25,000. Anya and Donna Marie taking your calls, Donna Marie producing the show today as well, or you can use comments at Highland Radio via email, or use at Highland Radio on Twitter, Highland Hub on Facebook and other social media platforms as well. Quarter says every school should be a Gaelic school, not just the odd Gaelic school. We are in part destroying the next generation's future, because if you do not care about the language itself, you will want to do so for your health reasons, for your children, because speaking two or more languages delays the onset of Alzheimer's, and medical studies have shown that to be the case. I have been trying to get into my local GP for 2 days now. The answering machine has been saying they're closed rather than they are at full capacity. I don't know what to do. I'll end up having to go to the emergency department. The other option, Quarter, is to try the now out of our service as well. That might be another way to go if you were to try that in the evening. It might be a better alternative to the emergency department, because we know how under pressure that emergency department is. A caller is asking about the ongoing pavement upgrade in Fintown, expressing some concerns about the length of time it's taking for the work to be done. No one should be against any improvement, the caller says, in terms of safety for residents or drivers, but the length this project is taking is a stretch. It would be very interesting to see the costs involved in what appears to be a relatively small roads project. I hope it turns out to make the roads safer than before, but I would question whether what's happening in Fintan at the moment represents value for money. That's what a caller is saying there. Caller saying, I was listening to one of your programmes recently and heard that some landlords in Donegal are receiving €35 per night per refugee that they rent a home to. When I inquired about this with the council, they said there is only one payment of €800 per house. Can you tell me what the actual situation is? Off the top of my head, honestly, no, I can't. Here's what I think may be, and I think we may be speaking about two slightly different things here. I think the €35 per night may be, and I stress maybe, the rate that is paid for refugees who are staying in hotels or other buildings which have been given over. We hear much about the holiday accommodation that's been given over for the housing of refugees. A number of hotel rooms have been used for that purpose as well. I think it may be the situation, and I stress it may be the situation, that that's what the €35 per night refers to, whereas the €800 payment refers to homes where individuals take refugees into their homes. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about that, the people that may have a spare room in their house give that room over in a private house, and that may be, so they're not landlords, they're effectively taking in a refugee into their own home, which is being treated in a different way. So my perception is it could well be that the first one is the payment given to landlords in hotels and other institutions like that. The second is the payment given per house to people who are taking refugees into their home. Now, I may be wrong on that. I could be, as an old mate of mine, you say, I could be further out than Fannad Lighthouse. But that's my initial We'll try and get an actual answer to that for you, but that's my perception. Repairs to a burst water main, we're told by Ishka Aaron, may cause supply disruptions to Creggan, Stranorlar and other surrounding areas in Donegal. Traffic management will be in place for the duration of the works. They're expected to take place until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We recommend you allow 2 to 3 hours after the estimated restoration time for your supply to fully return. You can go to the Ishka Aaron Irish Water website for updates on that particular issue. And there's been a lot of attention this week to emergency departments and the overcrowding therein. We've just received the INMO's Trolley Watch figures for today, Thursday, March 30th. And let's look at the figure. We know there's been fairly high figures all this week. And the national figure this week, I can tell you, is 562. The figure for Letterkenny University Hospital this morning, 41 patients awaiting beds at Letterkenny University Hospital this morning. That is 41 people who have been admitted to the hospital via the emergency department. they're awaiting beds, and of those, 13 are still on trolleys in the emergency department. That was the situation as of 8 o'clock this morning, figures collated by the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. So, you know, that's again an indication of the pressure that the ED is under. So what I would say to the caller is, look, if you can avoid the emergency department, please do. Is there anyone else finding broadband is getting harder to pay? My package started at €53. Now it's gone to €83 a month, and I'm charged €6 for receiving bills in the post. And I'm noticing that more and more we're getting to situations where there are people who get into these contracts and then, you know, they say, oh yeah, I will have a paper bill, because a lot of people do like paper bills so they can keep a record of them. We're being charged for it. Wishing all the staff and students of PCC Fulcara the very best of luck with their four-night sellout musical. Thank you for the music, which is starting tonight at Artlan in Gwydor. It'll be a fantastic show. We're all very proud of them, and we add our congratulations and our best wishes to that. And the caller says, Paddy Diver is the real voice of the people in Donegal in terms of the defective blocks crisis. Our elected representatives only come about their own pockets in the here and now. They seem to have no insight into the crisis that's unfolding in front of us. Thousands upon thousands of homeowners are affected. It affects mental and physical health. People are swamped in debt over the head of it. We have no houses available for rental. So says a caller. It is 14 minutes past 10. One of the sadder parts about working in a local radio newsroom in a county like Donegal is that periodically we have to report on tragedies on the water and report on the loss of fishers and other people who are out on boats. And that was the case in 2018 in North Inishowen, when there were losses. And I'm joined on the line by Donna Marie Keenan. And Donna Marie, you have more reason than most to remember what happened off Malin Head in 2018.
We do, Donna. We do. In July, the 17th of July 2018, my dad, my husband, and my little cousin Thomas went out for a day's fishing, as you know they had done many, many times before. And unfortunately, on that day, the engine was given a little bit of trouble, and the boys anchored up. It was just a minor thing while they pumped the fuel back to the engine. And unfortunately, they were hit by a freak wave which flooded the boat. At that point, my dad told my husband Desi to call for the Coast Guard, which he'd done. Desi's 999 call lasted for 78 seconds, and he managed to get out all the information. He said, there's three of us, we're on a boat, we're off Malin Head, we're taking on water, the boat's going down. But the call was never responded to. This happened at 10:16 in the morning, and in the afternoon, I believe about maybe 20 past four or so, some holidaymakers in Malin Head seen what they thought was a kayaker in distress, and they called out the Coast Guard. But unfortunately, by that stage, Dad had been lost, Thomas had been lost, and Desi had survived by clinging to the life buoy. That was what they thought was the kayak, but he was actually rescued by Philip Doherty. A Malin Head man coming home from fishing, he brought Desi in out of the water.
You obviously at that point, for the next couple of days, you were grieving your dad, you were grieving your cousin, the family was coming together to try to come to terms with the enormity of this horrible thing that had happened to you. Obviously at that point in time, you weren't thinking about things like marine safety and timetables and what happened and who responded to what. As time unfolded and the whole process of an inquiry came out, you were very dissatisfied with the way things panned out.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. This report, you know, we all hung our hats on. We were told that, you know, the MCIB would do a report, you know, into the accident. They would investigate everything fully. And the guards explained to us over and over that the MCIB investigation would not blame anyone, that they were not allowed to blame or infer blame. It was simply a minute by minute account of the day of everything, you know, that actually happened. But that wasn't the way that this report came out at all. As I mentioned, that, you know, the main thing on the day was that the 999 call was not responded to. But what the MCIB wanted to focus on was the fact that Dad didn't have a VHI radio on board. Now, a VHI radio is not law on a pleasure craft. It is on a commercial craft. Now, we know after all this that it's a very good idea to have a VHI radio. But at the time, you know, it wasn't law. You know, we thought that the mobile phone, you know, was fine, and it was. The mobile phone got a, you know, a 78-second long 999 call out with all the information. But MCIB decided to focus on the fact that Dad didn't have a VHI radio, because if he had, other boats in the area would have gotten the Mayday call, and they wouldn't have been solely reliant on 999 answering the call. Which to me now, after the fact, I know, and I would advise anyone going near the water to have a VHI radio with them, because you can't rely, as sadly we know, on the, you know, your 999 call to, you know, to be responded to. They said that he failed to prepare, and this again was covering the, you know, the VHI radio aspect of it. They didn't mention, you know, that he had spare fuel, that he had a spare engine with him, a spare battery, two sets of jump leads, anything. You know, he was so safety conscious, and they just based their whole report on how he didn't have this VHI radio.
Let's put it out there. Effectively, do you believe that what the MCIB, the Marine Casualty Investigation Board, was effectively doing was subtly blaming your dad?
Yes, victim blaming. Yes. And through the process of, through the whole process, as you say, as it went on and it went on, a marine lawyer from Europe, a man by the name of Michael Kingston, got in contact with us. And Michael has been working on this for years with many other families. And it's 23 years of existence. I mean, the MCIB reports are all online for anyone to look at. You go back through all them, they've blamed the victims. The victims are to blame. They make these recommendations in every report, but the recommendations are never implemented. They, you know, like, well, I'll give you an example. Just while I was waiting to come on to speak to you this morning, Donal, I was just sitting going through my phone, and I'm friends on Facebook with Water Safety Ireland. And Water Safety Ireland are brilliant. They're run by brilliant people. I am not knocking these people in any way, shape or form. They do a great job. But 14 hours ago, Water Safety Ireland posted, it's an like a poster for summer, and it shows a woman driving a boat. And it says, before you go on or near the water, make a plan. Make sure you let someone ashore know where you're going, when to expect you back, and that you have a means of communication. Signed by gov.ie/summerready.
Yeah.
They say a means of communication. They still don't say purchase a VHI radio.
I mean, VHF radio, as you say, VHF is the standard on the water. Yes, a VHF radio is probably the ultimate thing to have. But again, it comes back to that point. It was not law, and there were means of communication on that boat. There was a 999 call made from it. So that call had been made. Yeah. Was enough attention given, to your mind, to what happened after that 999 call was made on shore?
No, definitely not. It was just basically, Donal, it was a perfect storm of mistakes. You could never again get so many people to make a mistake at the same time. What happened was, the call went, when you ring 999 in Ireland, your call goes to BT ECAS in Navan. The woman in Navan, she answered the phone, hello, would you like fire police, fire, Garda, ambulance or Coast Guard? At this, Desi says, Coast Guard. Now, you have to remember, he's in between the first wave had hit, just before the second one hit. And she says, would you like the Coast Guard in Donegal? And Desi says, yes, we're on a boat. There's three of us. We're off Malin Head. We're taking on water. The boat's going down. Then the lady says, okay, connecting you to Coast Guard. by the time the Coast Guard answered, they couldn't hear anything because the second wave had already hit. The operator stayed silent, as is apparently the protocol, and Malinhead couldn't hear anything, so they hung up. The woman in BTE cast, and she then elevated this to her supervisor, who said, and she said, "I don't feel that this call has got the attention that it deserves." The supervisor then, according to her policies and procedures, should have re-listened to the call and made contact with Malinhead. She didn't listen to the call, and she went ahead and phoned Ballyshannon and asked them, "Did you receive a call?" "No, this is, we didn't receive a call, but we'll check with Malinhead." So Ballyshannon called Malinhead, and Malinhead said, "Yes, we did receive a call. We're ringing it. All we're getting is message minder." And the whole thing was put to bed. No one, no, the Coast Guard, and at the inquest, the Coast Guard said that they did not get enough information to launch a response, which is fair enough, they didn't. But on that original 999 call, the operator, the emergency responder on the first live call has the option to say, "Operator, replay call." And that will replay the call right from the beginning. Had the Malinhead Coast Guard said, "Operator, replay call," they would have heard everything right from when the call originally connected. And when they were asked at the inquest, "Why didn't you use the playback facility?" they said, "We didn't know about it. We didn't know it existed. We were never trained in it."
Yeah. The inquest, as you refer to, there were two inquests. There was a digital inquest initially during COVID. Then there was an inquest in Letterkenny, which was overseen by Dr. Dennis McCauley, no stranger to this programme in other circumstances. One of the things that was interesting is that MCIB, whose evidence it would appear and whose report is crucial to this, they didn't attend the inquest. And he was critical of that fact.
No. He was. Apparently, it's never been done before. The MCIB have never refused. They have always turned up at inquests and, you know, been examined on the report. You know, as Dr. McCauley says, you know, if you're good enough to write a report, you know, why can't I question the person? Why can't I ask you questions about the report, you know, that you've wrote and studied? And they refused. They were actually on the Zoom calls, as you say. The digital, there was a lady from the MCIB, and she was nothing short of ignorant to Dr. McCauley. And the day in the courthouse, now I can't remember exactly which one of it was, but there was a group of lawyers, you know, standing outside, and I heard one of them saying to the other that it was the most blatant disregard and disrespect that he had ever seen shown to a coroner in all his years, you know, as a legal practitioner. You know, that he just showed disrespect for our coroner. It was also for us as well. You know, they were kind of like, "There's the report, use it or don't, it's up to yourself."
You believe that...
It was terrible.
You believe an inquiry is necessary into this case, but also into maritime public safety in general, because certainly from what you've been saying, as you say, there was a perfect storm of mistakes, and if someone had said one thing, then somebody else might have done something else, and somebody might have heard something, and you know, it's, you know, if what and maybe, you know, are coming up, you will argue, I'm sure, way too often in this discussion. There needs, you believe, to be an inquiry that can look at all these issues in the round, not try to put blame on someone, not try to hang somebody out to dry, but very much to try and say, look, what procedures do we need? What do we need to put in place? What do we need to ensure that this does not happen again?
Yes, and that was supposed to be the role of the MCIB when they were set up 23 years ago. There were supposed to be five independent people, you know, totally independent of anyone, who would carry out these investigations, find out what happened, why it happened, and implement procedures so as, you know, to prevent a recurrence happening in the future. Now, 3 years ago, Eamon Ryan, when this all, you know, Michael Kingston, the Marine lawyer, you know, he started bombarding, you know, the government with evidence of, you know, all these families and all these investigations that weren't right and all these things that wasn't right. Eamon Ryan, fair play to him, he did. He ordered an investigation into the MCIB and maritime safety in Ireland. And he asked a man by the name of Captain Steve Clinch. Now, Captain Clinch was the former head of England's version of the MCIB. Now, Captain Clinch done this report and completed it almost 2 years ago. Now, This report has never been released. First of all, Eamon Ryan kept saying, yes, I'll release it in the first quarter of next year. I'll release it in the last quarter of next year. And then the Transport Committee, along with lawyers such as Michael Kingston and Kieran McCarthy, they were all really, really wanting this report, and it wasn't forthcoming. So on the 22nd of February, at a meeting in the Oireachtas of the Transport Committee, they asked Eamon Ryan about getting the report, the Captain Clinch report, published. And he said no, that the Attorney General had decided that it was not in the public interest to release Captain Clinch's report. But what he would do was he would give the 6 recommendations that Captain Clinch had recommended. And he said that these were satisfactory, that the MCIB would be dissolved and a new unit set up, the MAIU, and the 6 recommendations of Captain Clinch would be the basis of setting up the MAIU, but the Clinch report, under advice from the Attorney General, would not be released to not only the public, it wouldn't be released to the Transport Committee or anyone in the Dáil either.
MAIU, I presume Marine Accident Investigation Unit.
Investigation Unit, yeah.
Which essentially, it's the same thing, just changing the name and hopefully getting a better system in. Were you told what the 6 recommendations are?
Mm-hmm. I don't know them yet. It's only the Transport Committee that has them. They haven't been made public. But I think that one of them is, because I've heard a lot of talk about it, the 5 people that sat on the previous MCIB, none of them had any seagoing experience. They had no qualifications in the Marine. They had like business, advertising, law degrees. They had nothing to do with the Marine. So one of the stipulations of the new MAIU is going to be that these people must be qualified and experienced to the highest in the Marine. I believe I've heard talk of the head position in there. I think it's called the Chief Surveyor. I think one of the things that's going to be implemented there is that this person must have 25 years experience as a ship's captain or similar. So that these new 5 people are going to be educated and experienced, to the highest in the Marine, which is a massive one.
Donna Marie, hopefully you will get some closure on this, and I know you will continue to mourn the loss of your dad, you'll continue to mourn the loss of your cousin, but I'm sure if we do get this new unit, if we do get an inquiry along the lines that you're seeking, and if we do get safer and better regulations in there at some point in the hopefully not too distant future, that will be at the very least a fitting tribute to your dad and to your cousin, and it will hopefully bring you some closure. In the meantime, Donna Marie Keenan, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. We have asked the Department of Transport for a statement as well, and if we get anything back from them, obviously we'll bring it to you straight away. Hello to all those who are listening online and watching the feed on Facebook, watching the feed on YouTube. Anita says, good morning, Highland Radio from the Cayman Islands. Have a great day, all of you. Funny, I was talking to someone about the Caymans only earlier this week. I had the pleasure once of visiting the Cayman Islands on a cruise ship, and I have a lovely photograph of myself kissing a stingray while standing beside a catamaran that we'd sailed into this area called Stingray City on. And it's one of my most beloved memories, actually, from a Caribbean cruise. So I have fond memories of kissing stingrays in the waters just off the Cayman Islands and snorkeling there as well. And it's a far cry from kissing stingrays off in the Caribbean. We are here this morning. It's 25 to 11. I'm going to take a short break back after these. Right now, though, I want to go to a very important issue, because you may well have heard our coverage of the Dáil hearing on the confidence motion in the government yesterday. During it, Donegal's Deputy Thomas Pringle made a very impassioned speech, during which he spoke about Emma, a woman in Donegal who was waiting 5 years for an accessible home for her child. And he spoke about the difficulty that Emma had, and said it was people like Emma that he wanted to represent in the floor of the Dáil, and that's why he was voting the way he voted on that confidence motion. Delighted to say that Emma now joins us on the line. Emma, good morning.
Good morning.
Emma, you were spoken about on the floor of the Dáil yesterday, and you've had some progress in recent times, but before politicians took up your case and before it became spoken about in the corridors of power, you had 5 years of banging your head against a brick wall.
Yeah, because you're kind of trying to sort it out yourself first, you know. You're hoping that you'll just find something. and you can't find anything. And then you just feel like you're going in a vicious circle.
You have a child who is a wheelchair user, and that's an added challenge for yourself and indeed for her as well, because, you know, she long-term is going to be in that wheelchair, and that's something that you have to factor in and she has to factor in as part of everyday life.
Yeah, well, you see, this is the thing, and, you know, you're trying to make life easier for her. You know, I saw a lot, you know, yesterday when it was spoken about in the dog floor, and then, you know, of course it started to be repeated through social media and things like that, and so much support. And then you see people saying things like, oh, she probably just wants a big house with a big garden, and you know, why can't she sort it out herself? And they don't know anything about our situation, do you know, that kind of way. And you're thinking to yourself, I have a child with a diagnosis of a devastating disease, and, you know, she's in agony all the time. The disease that she has or the syndrome that she has, it's taken so much from her already. And this isn't about, you know, I want, so give me. This is about trying to make life easier for her.
Yeah, and as long as you have to worry about housing, as long as you have to worry about accommodation, as long as you have to worry about where you're going to be in 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years from now, that's time you cannot be worried about and devoting to her. And what you effectively, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think what you would say is, look, I do not need to be worrying about accommodation. I need to know that accommodation is sorted so I can devote all my energies where those energies need to be devoted.
This is it. Look, I have another child with special needs. I have two children with profound needs. And, you know, all of my time is taken up with caring for them, but all of that time, you know, should not, at the back of my mind, I shouldn't be thinking, you know, like, I have to carry my child up and down the stairs. We're in a two-story house. So she's carried up and down the stairs. And the syndrome that she has means her bones come apart easily. So can you imagine how agonising that is, being lifted and carried upstairs, and maybe your shoulder and your elbow and all coming apart, to be reduced back into place when you get back upstairs. Yeah. And she's to be lifted in and out of the bath because there's no disability bathroom. This is a child who is already in pain, who will never be pain-free.
Yeah.
She knows that. When the pain specialist talked to us, he said, you know, at the moment before we start this pain management routine, she's probably at about an 8 out of 10 because she's having multiple dislocations a day. Her joints come apart every day.
Yeah.
So he's saying, you know, she's never going to be pain-free. The best I can probably get her to is a 4. So this child is in pain all of the time. And then extra pain has been added to her because she'd have to be lifted upstairs, lifted in and out of the bath. And aside from the physical pain that is causing her, where's the dignity in that? You know, what about her right to dignity? You know, when we get to our front door, I have to lift her out of her wheelchair and sit her on her bum on the pavement. They bring the wheelchair in and then bring her in a step at a time and then get her back into her wheelchair in the house to get her into sitting room. When she's coming down the stairs in the morning, you know, you're carrying her down the stairs and then you get her onto her wheelchair, you take her into sitting room, and it's the same to go back up the stairs. And when she's going into the bath, you know, the bathroom's not big enough, so you're parking the wheelchair in the hall and you're lifting her and you're carrying her, and then you have to sit her then on the toilet to run the bath, to get her into the bath. I mean, and now, because we can't get her in and out of the bath anymore because she's getting older and she's getting bigger, so the option that we have available to us now is what they call a bath sword. And they basically sit her across the bath and she will sit on that and you'll shower her down. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the day is now coming when she's going to turn around and say, listen, I want to do this on my own. I want my privacy. I want to do it.
That day is already.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That day's been gone.
Yeah, I know.
That day's been gone a couple of years ago. And it's kind of like, you know, I want that for her.
Yeah.
I want a day where she can go in to her bed and transfer from her wheelchair to her bed without having to cry out in pain because she's in agony. I want a day where I can, if I have to help her get into the bathroom, of course, but I can leave her in there and say, right, here you go, there's the shower. in the wet room and let her do it herself, and she can call me when she needs help.
Yeah, and really and truly, what you need is a bungalow with accessible facilities, both in terms of entry into the house and also the facilities in the house itself, and in particular the shower, the toilet, and so on and so forth. How close are you to getting that at this point in time?
Well, you know, I think it's very important. I said this yesterday, and people were saying to me, well, we understand where you're coming from, but, you know, don't be scared to say it as it is. But I am saying it as it is. I don't believe in playing the blame game and pointing, you know, it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault. You know, I have been liaising with the council, and our medical team and our key worker and all have been liaising with the council. They're saying they just don't have that available to them. And so I met with Charlie McConnell, and then he arranged a meeting with Darragh O'Brien yesterday, and kind of an impromptu meeting, but a meeting which was, I appreciated very much. And Deputy Pringle had arranged to bring us down to the Doyle to talk about McHale's case. And our local TDs, Padraig McLaughlin, had been engaging with us as well. And we saw him yesterday. And Darragh O'Brien assured me yesterday in person that this was going to be resolved. He said to me that the capital was there and he would be engaging with the council, and Minister McConnell would be engaging with the council. And I said to him, what kind of time are we looking at? Because, you know, I've been told this could take years.
Yeah.
And he said, and I said, oh, you know, Michaela has a progressive disease.
Yeah.
It's not fair. We know that she's not going to get any better. She's only going to get worse. Yeah. And we know that. And she has the right to enjoy. The last time a consultant spoke with us was 3 weeks ago. And I said this to him yesterday, and he told us not to think about the past, don't plan for the future, just live in the now.
Yeah.
So that's what we have to do. And I said, and it's impossible to do that when you're lying awake at night wondering, how do I make this better for her?
Yeah.
Because I can't, believe me, I have told the internet apart trying to find some sort of treatment, some sort of trial, anything that will bring her back to the way she was. Bring her back to the wee 4 and 5 year old that we knew.
Yeah.
And it's not happening anymore. It's like, oh, there is no cure for this. We're really sorry, but it's genetic and there's no cure. She had that when she was a 4 or 5. Maybe it just wasn't presenting.
Yeah.
And you're going, okay, so I can't take this from her. I can't take it for her. So all I can try and do is make things easier for her.
And what you're saying to Donegal County Council and to Darragh O'Brien and to anyone who will listen is, look, we know the situation we're in, and what you're saying is, look, anything you can do and anything that the council can do to make the situation better, if you have access, as we said, a bungalow so you don't have to carry her up the stairs, a ramp so you don't have to pick her up and lift her upstairs and put the wheelchair in the front door and then walk in after and put her, as you said, put her bum first onto the pavement. I mean, if you can have a ramp into the house, if you can have a proper wet room with shower, if you can get those, at least you'll make her somewhat more comfortable and take some of the pain
away. Well, we've had somebody at TSS and they can't put a ramp in because of the incline, they've said.
Yeah.
They would have to dig up the whole front area.
Yeah, so where you are at the moment, it isn't possible.
And they can't adapt this house. They said that. They said we can't adapt this house. It's just, and you know what? It's also really important to say that, you know, this is not about demonising private landlords. So the landlords who own this house are very nice people. We've never had a problem with them. After I move out, my parents will continue to stay here.
Yeah.
They like it here. They find the landlords easy to work with.
Yep.
So this is not about, you know, demonising landlords. I've heard a lot of people saying that recently. Yeah. You know, these are nice people. It's just the house is not suitable for a person who is so physically disabled.
Well, look, hopefully, as you said, Darragh O'Brien is on the case, Charlie McConnell is on the case, Patrick McLaughlin, Thomas Pringle, Donegal County Council, between them all, surely they can manage to say, okay, we're going to build what's necessary and it should be done. And look, hopefully it can be done in a matter of months. If not, well, weeks would be unrealistic. We won't be unrealistic, but certainly this needs to be a matter of months. You need to be in your new home before the end of this year.
Yeah, please God,
because
we're just about keeping our head above water at this stage.
Well, look, Emma, all we can do is say, I mean, I feel for you and I absolutely feel the pain, and I know how much you would like to get this, you know, her health sorted, and you know the limitations, you know what's ahead, and you're facing that in a realistic way, as is Michaela herself as well. And all we can say is, look, hopefully anything that can be done by the council and by the wider society to make things better, to make things more comfortable, to make day-to-day life better and more bearable for you, hopefully that will be done and will be done immediately. In the meantime, Emma, our thoughts go with you. Thanks for speaking to us this morning.
Thanks so much, Nader. Bye-bye.
Emma, you take care. That's Emma there. And, I mean, we heard Deputy Pringle speak about it in the Dáil yesterday, but I think it's always important that you hear about these cases. And I said the same thing to Paddy Diver when he spoke about Mary and the situation Mary is in, because I recalled Mary speaking at that event in Letterkenny outside the community centre there, along with Gerry Hone and others back in 2020. And I think it's important that we always realise that when you hear people talked about in the Dáil and you hear stories, there are real people behind those stories. Yesterday, we heard the political references to Emma. Today, we heard Emma. Sunny spells and scattered showers today. Some heavy with a chance of isolated thunderstorms. Cloud will thicken from the south later. Top temperatures of 13 to 15 degrees Celsius with moderate southwesterly winds backing southeast later. That's the situation with the weather forecast. Now, one of the big questions that's being asked is, will Joe Biden come to Donegal? Because we've heard that Joe Biden is being invited to Donegal when he comes to Ireland, we believe next month. I'm sure every county in the country is going to be inviting Joe Biden, and every county in the country is frantically struggling for a 14th cousin 16 times removed, or to find a pub where Joe Biden's great-great-great-granduncle once had a pint in, and we're really good for that in this country. But it will be the latest in a series of visits to Ireland by US presidents that started way back with President John F. Kennedy, joined by Sean McKiernan on Zoom. Sean is a political commentator. Sean, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Donald, and to all of your listeners in Donegal and across the world.
Thank you very much indeed. Sean, you've taken an interest in visits of US presidents to Ireland over the years, going right back to John F. Kennedy, and as someone who's originally from Waterford, just across the river from Wexford, and just a couple of kilometres down the road from New Ross. That's an area that will always be connected with John F. Kennedy. Indeed, when I was a child, one of our go-to excursions for the day was John F. Kennedy Park in Wexford, which was just a short distance back. So the Kennedy legacy is one that I was always aware of. But there's been a number of US presidential visits to this country over the years.
Well, Donald, Joe Biden will become the 8th sitting US president to visit this country. 7 of his predecessors have visited this country while in office. It's worth noting that George W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, as he's referred to, who people may remember successfully prosecuted the first Gulf War and liberated the city of Kuwait, he visited as a vice president in the early 80s. And Joe Biden himself visited as vice president towards the end of his term in office. And I suppose a lot of the work in terms of tracing his roots was done then by people in Mayo and in Louth, and I think that's why those two counties will feature heavily in the visit. I don't want to be disappointing the people of Donegal, and I've no particular insight into the plan beyond what's available publicly in the media. But I think those two counties, Louth and Mayo, will dominate alongside engagements in Dublin and in Northern Ireland.
People will look back on recent times on the Clinton visit, which was very important to us because, of course, President Bill Clinton visited Guildhall Square in Derry, just up the road from us here in Donegal. And that proved a very, very important visit from the point of view of cementing the peace process. And indeed, one of the iconic scenes in Derry Girls reflects that really, really well. And, you know, it's important to look back and say that maybe these US presidential visits, they haven't all been self-serving electioneering visits from their point of view. They've made some very, very positive impacts and very tangible impacts here as well.
Yeah, I mean, you could make an argument that they are slightly self-serving. I did an item with Greg and with other people across the media locally and nationally a few weeks ago during St. Patrick's Week. And, you know, I discovered in my research in the Kennedy Library online that in 1961, Sir John F. Kennedy's first shamrock ceremony in the White House, he actually had to be reminded of a St. Patrick's Day. Now, we'll give him maybe a little bit of grace and say that The US president was a very busy and demanding and distracting job. But on that occasion, he had to borrow a green tie from one of his Secret Service detail, a guy called John Muggsy O'Leary. But our ambassador on that occasion, Thomas J. Kiernan, obviously made a big impression on him because the following year, in 1962, Kennedy is issuing a very warm statement acknowledging between the two countries. And of course, in 63, you've that iconic visit, which you yourself have referred to very well, Donald, in your opening remarks. It obviously had a big impact on the people of the Southeast. It had a big impact on the people of the country. And Ryan Tuberty wrote extensively about this for the 50th anniversary and indeed did a TV documentary. And he called it 4 days to change the president. You know, he actually talked about coming back in the spring. And it was that's deeply poignant because he didn't live to see the spring. He died in November. And in fact, he was deeply moved by the honor guard of Irish Army cadets that he saw on his visit to Arbor Hill during his 4 day visit. And he talked about it a lot with his staff after the visit, and such that in actual fact, when he was being buried in Arlington Cemetery in Virginia, the flag ceremony, so people may be familiar with this from dramas on TV, etc., where the US flag is folded in a very poignant and beautiful way. And all of those graveside honours were actually done by Irish Army cadets because what he had seen in Arbor Hill moved them so poignantly. And I think actually there's a documentary available somewhere on that as well.
When Obama came, there was almost a sense of the wheel turning full circle, because Obama very much painted in many circles as the new Kennedy. And Obama, perhaps more than any other US president, came as, I don't want to use the phrase came as a rock star, because it's something of a cliche, but it's not entirely wrong either, because there was that element of that this was the big celebrity who was coming, and, you know, it was all this fiddling and all that. And there was something about the Obama visit that sort of seemed to harken back to the first Kennedy visit.
Yeah, I know you want to move on to Obama, but it was just to stress, the first Kennedy visit, Tuberty said it changed the president. I would argue it changed the country. The country was starting to become more prosperous. Immigration was still an issue, but we were starting to become more prosperous. And the mass was Taoiseach. He was trying to modernise the country. We hadn't joined NATO. That left us a little bit isolated on the world stage. We were only fresh into the UN, etc. So that visit was about us arriving on the world stage. I think the Ireland of 2011 that Obama visited, obviously we've been shook by the financial crisis, we've been shook by the recession, but we're still a far more wealthy, far more advanced country than we were in the 60s, more self-confident, more able to look at them as an equal. He was an extremely eloquent speaker. He was a historical figure, the first black president. As you say, there was that element of coolness about him. And I think the country needed something to cheer it up in 2011. It was also a very historic week. The Queen had been here. That visit had gone incredibly well. And I suppose we all felt very good about ourselves. And it was also a time of reflection. Dr. Garrett Fitzgerald died. So again, it was time to look. And he, of course, was the great constitutional crusader. He'd done a lot to modernise the country. So I think that week was a very heady week of emotions. And Obama tapped into that very successfully in his speech at College Green.
Almost inevitably, the Biden visit, however it's framed, and we haven't got an itinerary yet, we haven't got any details of will there be a major, one suspects there won't be a big, huge public speech in College Green attended by thousands. It'll be, I suspect, a far much more low-key affair.
Well, I think probably in the regions, I suspect you're going to see big crowds, because I would suspect the security risk is not as high. But I mean, I suppose security is a big backdrop to this, because the issues in Northern Ireland are not successfully resolved. And if they are, there's always going to be a rump who won't be happy. And for the first time in a long time, war has been prosecuted on the continent of Europe. And we are a country that is very fortunate to have headquartered in it major American companies with their European and in some cases their global operations headquartered here. So obviously that heightens the security risk, and it will potentially dampen the opportunity for ordinary members of the public to see and hear him.